Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I was going to say it's the original boys, but also Ben. So Ben, you're going to have to be, you're going to have to be folded into one of the boys now. So
oh no, do I get to choose which boy I have to fold into?
You could be Ben.
Oh, cool. I like that.
Yeah. Oh, so today we are talking about Zionism, the history of Zionism, and of course the consequences of that history in the present day will no doubt come up at some point. I'm going to go ahead and just draw some real basic, easy comparisons to the thing that I study, which is right-wing nationalism in Germany in between the wars, not the least of which is the National Socialists. And I got to say that when reading over these, especially the comparisons to settler colonialism, where you see labor Zionism, right? Labor Zionism being sort of this like culmination point for what ends up being a genocidal project rather than an exploitative project. Labor Zionism being parallel to exploitative versions of visions of National Socialism and what the Nazis were planning on doing to Eastern Europe. And I had never really made that comparison before, but it's there. Mm-hmm. Like the Nazis wanted to create an egalitarian Volksgemeinschaft that was based off exploiting other people's land and taking their wealth and then redistributing that and not the wealth of their own bourgeoisie, which is exactly what the labor Zionists wanted to do in the invasion of Palestine. But that's a comparison to Nazism that I think is one that people don't often make.
I think mostly because people have no idea about any of those things.
Right.
Because most of people think of Nazism as just not liking Jews and also being bad.
Right. We could start with labor. We could define our terms. Like, what is labor Zionism? What is, like, you know, mainstream Zionism? Where do they come from?
I have it on good authority from commentators on the Patreon and on the and so on that we should define our terms.
Okay. So the thing that there's a fissure or a dynamic that goes on with settler colonial endeavors. There's the exploitationists, mainly the bourgeoisie, right, who want to get as much cheap labor as possible from the indigenous population. And then there's the eliminationists, a.k.a. labor Zionism in this context that... this introduces the class dynamic of settler colonialism, right?
Right.
Because they are competing with said indigenous labor force.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they're going to want to eliminate the competition. That I think that is something that is totally lost from our understanding of the situation. And it's how, like, we come to see labor Zionism as, like, a progressive... like the more socialist part of this history.
Right.
And we can't understand why it was actually the one that led to the Nakba, the part of Zionism that led to the Nakba. But Zionism is like older than Nazism by several, like 30, 40 years, like Moses Hess, right? It's a contemporary of Marx, is one of the earliest Zionist thinkers. Also Zionism, if we're going to clarify the term, has a panoply of meanings, right?
Right. There's political and non-political Zionism.
There's cultural Zionism. Why
the comparison to Nazism is a, it's not exact. It's inapproximate. I mean, it's valuable. It's probably the best one. But early Zionism, you could trace it back to, you know, being a lot more like British colonialism or American settler colonialism.
Right. Well, like, I mean, the Nazi comparison is apt because of the active ongoing genocide.
Right.
And because of it being the point from which Israel springs is the rubble of the Holocaust, right? And other than that, there aren't really too many other comparisons that are useful.
Actually, au contraire, I would say reading this, so one of the articles that I shared was by Ilyan Pape, which we're probably familiar with from our ISO days. But
I read his Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine.
He's very good.
And he also did a book with Noam Chomsky, I believe, about Palestine.
Yeah, He was one of the I think they're called the dissident, the new Israeli scholars, this body of dissident scholars, so much so that he had to leave Israel. I think he's in the UK now. But anyway, he has this article where he's looking at Palestinian press, Palestinian newspapers from before the First World War, like 1912 to 1922, specifically focusing on Philistine. And it's quite early on that we see this kind of connection between the sort of racialized settler colonial vision coming from, I mean, everyone talks about Theodor Herzl, but this article, as well as the one that is dealing with the Jewish victims of Zionism, the rhetoric, the excerpts and quotations of rhetoric coming from, whether it's David Ben-Gurion or all these other figures, it sounds very, very, very close to like a Goebbels or a, you know, there's this resonance that is just kind of makes your spine tingle a little bit.
Well, I mean, there's those recent pronouncements by Netanyahu and others in the Israeli state whose pronouncements about the war in Gaza right now, or why I say war, how the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Gaza right now sound very much like Goebbels, like the children of light cleansing the, you know, the children of darkness from like the...
There's one...
It was especially eerie during Hanukkah. We were we were going to a comedy show in Hollywood and passed by this very... It just felt like I was passing through a fascist march, this eighth day of Hanukkah celebration. So Zionism has just totally captured, you know, cultural... Well,
especially where you are.
Yeah,
well, Hollywood.
Yeah, in Hollywood.
There's one critical factor that I feel like makes any direct historical comparisons or analogies not quite ever entirely accurate. And that's because it is like Nazism, and it is like Lebensraum in the East.
Mm-hmm.
Except for that, unlike the fascist hordes who were trying to colonize Ukraine and whatever, the settlers weren't sent back, which means that they had children, and their children had children, which means that now there are people who grow up in Tel Aviv who don't know any other reality other than being an Israeli. So in that sense, it's a lot more like being an American.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain version of
Europe was successful.
Right. Yeah. There's a certain version of being pro-Palestinian, which is akin to the kind of land back narrative in this country. Right. However justified it is, let's say, at the level of emotion, doesn't matter, because in a certain practical sense, it's not actionable. It's so not in that sense, Zionism is like, it started like the Eastern plan of the Nazis, but it has become like westward expansion of the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, after going through comparisons, drawing affirmative, looking at the likeness between Zionism and Nazism, it may also be useful to recognize some of the distinctions. Cause I mean, you can just like what you were just doing, Jason, because it's also very similar to classical settler colonialism, like you're just pointing out. But it's also got its own unique characteristics. You can make comparisons between all kinds of different political systems and recognize similarities and sort of downplay the dissimilarities in a way that actually obfuscates or confuses things. A very central feature of Zionism, political Zionism, is the eradication of non-Israelis, the indigenous population, from the land, which is a pretty, key characteristic to Nazism as well. And likewise to other settler colonial projects.
Yeah, Zionism kind of represents an apogee of classical patterns of settler colonialism. It is the highest expression of an older phenomenon that goes back to the first imperial expressions of early capitalism or of the early modern period before there's even a distinction that's quite made between capitalism and feudalism. It's the most modern expression of it. It's also just bad.
Yeah. I would say that in most of the British colonial ventures, the idea of keeping an indigenous population that is self-managed in order to exploit for cheap labor is key. Right. That's what and everywhere except for on the East Coast of the United States, actually. But if you look at, say, like, even in the more racist incarnations of that, like South Africa, which has the Boer element, right, which has like a hundreds of years long colonial project that has from the bottom up a radical sort of penchant or drive towards ethnically cleansing the land, because the Boers at the bottom of society don't want other laborers at the bottom of society to compete with. So there is that drive to ethnically cleanse South Africa. So you've got sort of like something like that going on in Palestine, but still you have the Bantustans, which the black people are allowed in South Africa are allowed to leave in order to work. And they work for the white people during the apartheid regime. But that is not possible in Gaza, and to a lesser extent, the West Bank, but definitely not now. So it's more like the reservations in the United States in that instance, or like the ghettos in Eastern Europe.
Well, right, because Zionist Project, they have a darker skinned Jews, they have a Sephardim to exploit, to be the laborers, which means that Arabs are a surplus population to them.
There are a small number of Arabs that live within Israel that are like that sort of second or third class layer of citizens.
I think it's
that can be
20%.
Exploited.
I think it's 20% within the 48 borders. So within the state of Israel, and apparently, I know this article I shared, Sephardim in Israel by Ella Shoat.
Was really interesting to me. I hadn't really read much about that.
1988. So she's saying the majority of the Israeli Jewish population is Sephardic, I'm not sure anymore if that's true.
Now it's like, I think that a majority of the population of Jews in Israel is either Sephardic or Mizrahi. And I think a majority of that group is Sephardic, but I think that they are very close to being equal to Mizrahi as far as let me look that up so I'm not just fucking saying shit wrong on the
You look that up for a significant portion of the history of the state of Israel, you had a small elite minority of Ashkenazi European Jews who were ruling over. I mean, that's where some of that rhetoric I was referring to earlier is in reference to quote unquote Oriental Jews or Eastern Jews.
Right.
Right.
Some of that language, it was like, whoa, like this is very uncannily close to what I think of as regard to fascist rhetoric, especially with purity of the race. That stuff, it's like, whoa, it's like,
it's amazing actually how clear and how out front and just open they are about this stuff too.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but I mean, you can go back and look at American settler period discussion of European colonists versus African slaves versus indigenous populations, and discussions of talking about like the importance of good stock or whatever, and even making distinctions between the European migrant populations in the United States about, you know, the better or the worse or the more pure and whatever else, and depending who you're talking to or who was doing the writing, you know, there's different sorts of valuations of what's who the good ones are, but some of them very clearly, you know, like the only good ones were like the British,
Right,
or very closely related.
Right.
some others would have, you know, the boundaries would broaden out a lot more. But I mean, anyway, the racial consciousness of settler projects in any British or other, you know, European settler project historically was rife with racial ideology. Any post transatlantic slave trade settler project is, you know, shot through with this kind of like race essentialism that,
right.
I think it, you know, it makes it, I think it's important to not pretend like the Nazis are the only ones who were ever homicidally, genocidally racist.
Well, no, because the Third Reich took great inspiration from the Confederacy and antebellum South, right? And
it did, and it regarded the Nazis in their study of American race law regarded the American race law as being too harsh because the Nazis decided that Aryan blood was strong enough to drown out the impure blood so long as it was 50% or more of a person.
Right, yeah.
Whereas in American jurisprudence, we have the one drop rule.
One drop rule.
If you have one drop of black blood, then you are black.
Well, that part, but I was thinking when you were talking earlier, like the flexibility of the racial caste system or whatever in the early republic was only with it followed these waves of migration. So the invention of the white race is constantly, okay, well, the Irish, no. And then at a certain point, you have the new waves of immigration from Southern Europe. And it's like, oh, okay, Irish, you can be white.
Yeah, so at least you're not Italian.
At least you're not Italian.
Well, and
so
like,
I guess
is it also goes the other way too, because, you know, if you're of Persian or Arabic ethnic background,
right,
you were white all the way up until I think I don't remember the exact year, but sometime in the late 70s or the early 80s.
So this is interesting. Like, I'm looking for statistics on this, and like most people are conflating Mizrahi and Sephardim. They're saying like that they make up around 55%. Mizrahi and Sephardim make up 55% of the Jews, but I cannot figure out, like, because they're not all from the Middle East. You know, most Sephardic Jews are from North Africa, the ones that are left anyway. So like, it's not like, it's interesting, I guess, because they're not white, right?
Right.
So they kind of just lump them together. I don't know what the deal is, though. It's showing that like it's saying that one thing that I found said the 55% are Mizrahi, and the other one I found said the 55% are Sephardim. So anyway, well, it's kind of like how
everybody just talks about Egypt as an Arab country, even though Egyptians are not Arab. You know?
Yeah.
Just because it's easier, because it's still just the vague East, and it's still just negative, and so whatever, it's Arab, it's Muslim, it's all just non-us. It's just not white.
Anyway, so that doesn't really matter, because like the settler colonial project has like subsumed the non-Ashkenazi Jews that have moved to Israel into a greater sort of Europeanized culture.
Right.
That's sort of like the part of the conditions that are set up by the Europeanized state for people to be able to come in, because they still don't allow in Ethiopian and Somali Jews, if I understand correctly. I remember I watched a documentary about that a long time ago, that there's a population of African Jews that are as old as the Mizrahi who have been living in the Middle East for the past 2,000 years. This population that is that old, but they're not allowed to have the same status that most Jews have, because they're considered converts because they're too black, right?
So fucked. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're still thought of in very classical colonialist terms. The civilizing mission of the state of Israel will eventually rescue them from the darkness that they have experienced for all this time that they lived, you know, without anti-Semitism. And eventually they'll become Jewish. But until then, they can only be second class, because they're not exactly fully Jewish, which is to say they're not Polish or Brooklynite or whatever.
Right. And it's from the start. It's from right out of the mouth of Ben-Gurion from this article. We do not want Israelis to become Arabs. We are duty-bound to fight against the spirit of the Levant, which corrupts individuals and societies and preserve the authentic Jewish values as they crystallized in the diaspora. Very interesting.
Huh? Yeah, the authentic Jewish identity was the one that was created whenever it had to hide, as opposed to existing freely.
It looks like last year they started letting Ethiopian Jews in. They let 5,000 Ethiopian Jews in. But
last year?
But that was like a sort of like a singular act of, you know, admitting a certain number of refugees, that sort of thing, versus...
Well, they removed a ban on allowing African Jews. And then, of course, then it's on a case-by-case basis. So they removed a ban, right, and then they let in 1,500 Ethiopian Jews, and then later up to 5,000 are going to be allowed in.
Yeah.
So there is a cap at 5,000, unlike any other Jews of any other origin, primarily European or other Western origin.
Well, you know, Israel's starting to catch up to the 16th century.
Well, you know, it is what they're. I mean, I don't doubt that charges of blatant racism against other Jews that have been a part of criticism of Israel since the very beginning. Probably just don't look very good in today's society for Zionists who are trying to pretend to be liberal.
Right.
Right.
Like if you're reliant upon the goodwill of Zionists in the United States and Europe for the existence of your country, not allowing Jews whose skin is too dark into your country is not going to look good.
Right. Although this gets us into a bit of a quandary, because Shoat kind of paints this discourse that she is disproving coming from liberal Zionism, that Sephardic Jews from North Africa primarily, there's this discourse that they bring in sort of authoritarian mindsets. They're very right wing. And it is true that Sephardic Jews make up the Likud party in large part. But I think that
they're more orthodox. Sephardim and Mizrahim tend to be more conservative and more orthodox.
And there's this sort of Orientalist discourse that flattens that and to explain why.
Yeah.
But
that's, and in fact, I read an article a while ago in the, what is the LA newspaper? The big one, the big liberal LA newspaper,
LA Times.
Yeah. That was in the LA Times about how, it's not a settler colonial state and Jews aren't all white. In fact, the reason that Israel sucks and is bad is because of all the dark skinned Jews. Whoa. Is essentially what it was saying. It was saying that, like, the reason that Israel's right wing government has such a stranglehold on the country is because of all of the, Middle Eastern Jews that are in the Likud party and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
All these dark skinned racists, you know, they're coming in, they're making us racist.
Oh man, it looks like Israel is, you can really say some very simplistic things about Israel and have it be 100% true. Like, Israel is a settler colonial state that is practicing apartheid, and they're racist against Palestinians, they're ethnically cleansing Palestine, they're committing a genocide against Palestinian Muslims and Christians, you know, Palestinian Arabs. That's all true. But when you throw a term like white in there, that's when you confuse everything. But that's, you know, white people are bad, you know.
Well, right.
I mean, one thing as an American leftist that I have learned is that white people are bad. And consequently, brown people are good. Right. East good, West bad, brown good, white bad. You know what I mean? So you start trying to throw in these like overly simplistic understandings of things like that, like the categories of whiteness and brownness that exist from time immemorial, if you were to ask any American leftist.
Or also any classical European rightist.
Right.
But it makes perfect sense. Earlier we were talking about the class dynamic of the Zionist settler colonial project and how the quote-unquote progressive part of it was the most annihilationist, the most eliminationist, because their interests were served in that project, their class interests. And so we can see that the Sephardic Jews who have been oppressed, they've been a state within a state, their way in was by allying to the most right-wing factions of the society. However conservative they already were, that was their path to ascendance, right?
Mm-hmm. Like
It just makes sense politically. What would have happened if the elite liberal Zionists had made room, you know, following the founding of the state for a Sephardic demographic?
I think you would have like a lot less eliminationist philosophy at the core of the state of Israel. It would be one like India, where you'd have the East Israel Company exploiting Palestinian laborers or whatever, you know. One of the things that I thought was interesting when I was reading all this about labor Zionism, and of course, what are the communes called?
Kibbutzim,
kibbutzim, like these radical sort of egalitarian within certain bounds project in Israel that is completely built on a system of racist exploitation, and not even exploitation, racist eliminationism, obviously.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it reminded me of was Tony Cliff's biography. Did anyone else ever read that?
I did, but like a very long time ago, like 2006, maybe.
He's a Palestinian Jew, right? His family had immigrated there a long time before Israel was a country. And he, at a meeting of Trotskyists, of which he was a part, spoke up in defense of Palestinians and was beaten up and had all his fingers broken.
Oh my God.
By other Trotskyists in Israel. So it's like, which is, we was sort of the justification in the ISO always had for supporting the BDS movement, because there is no Israeli left.
Right.
Right. According to this paradigm, the way it exists is that the Israeli left, so far as it does exist, which and it's minuscule, is still reliant on the settler colonial state in order to exist.
I think
about as big as the American left.
Yeah.
Proportionally.
I think that's not true entirely. I think that the Israeli Communist Party, which I don't even know if that still exists. Maybe it does.
It does.
But, oh yeah, okay. So the Israeli Communist Party, at least historically, has maintained, I mean, they've maintained the kind of an ethic for a two-state solution. And at the time, when I was in the ISO, I saw that as being a concession to this project that had to go away or whatever. I think maybe now I recognize the necessity of it, but in general,
a two-state solution,
really just of the broader contours of the ethic behind that two-state solution as an expression.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is just to say that like the Israeli population is here to stay, period, now. And so because of that, some other political arrangement is going to have to be made, because you can't send these people back to anywhere.
Right. So, one of the things that I read was that most Israelis are mixed. So even though they're like technically a majority of them are classified as like Mizrahi or Sephardim, they're actually mixed with Ashkenazi. They just have a majority of their ancestry is Sephardi or Ashkenazi.
Yeah, I guess probably I shouldn't say two-state solution. I mean, the Israeli Communist Party definitely did, at least when I was more familiar with it. Mm-hmm. Essentially what I'm talking about is what is typically thought of as a one-state solution or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Israel, Palestine.
Yeah, as a single place.
It's a single place with equal rights for, you know, no distinctions of ethnicity, race, religion, whatever.
There's a hiccup there, though, which is that, like, that's not the preferred solution by the Arab or the Jewish population of Israel or Palestine.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, nobody there wants that right now.
But now that preference is kind of, it doesn't, it's it's over, I would
say. Well, and it's been over since, like, 1970.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So you know, being American leftist makes this issue super easy, because I can just say America, you know, my position is that my government needs to get the fuck out of the region and stop meddling, period.
Yeah.
And that's the end of my obligation, you know. Now, I suppose for the sake of like theoretical clarity or sort of playing scenarios out so that we could talk about like understanding the world more clearly, more broadly as we go forward and encounter new situations, and, you know, maybe even, God forbid, discuss, you know, our own, like what is the role of the left in the world as we prepare for power in some sort of imagined future? We should be able to define, you know, we should be able to think about, analyze the situation and say, here is the left position on what should happen in the region. I remember, you know, hearing Noam Chomsky talking about it, because he was advocating two-state solution, and somebody was like, hey, you know, that's not very progressive of you. Why don't you advocate for a one-state solution? And his response was a very Chomskyan response of, well, I'm an anarchist. My preferred solution is a no-state solution. But the fact is, we live in a constrained conditions, and this is a possible step in the right direction that could be taken. Effectively, was his response was, one-state solutions, just it's not. You're talking fantasies. A two-state solution could be practical, workable under existing international law.
This was recent?
This would have been, God, like 15, 20 years ago or something.
Because I feel like, I don't think that's the same. We're not in the same. I think that argument is kind of lost. I don't think that there can be a Palestinian state so long
as
the Israeli state.
That's exactly what I was going to try to edge toward is what I, you know, I don't, being a comfortable cynic in the West, I can just not, I don't have to pay attention to these things closely enough to be able to take a position necessarily one way or the other. But I wonder, you know, what about the response of like to the response to that response could potentially be, you know, where is a two-state solution? Like, how could a two-state, if we're calling solutions fantastical, then where is what does a two-state solution look like that doesn't isn't just this same problem continuing to reassert itself, the same antagonism between between Israel and Palestine, and I don't, you know, I don't like. I'm not sure what that looks like. Maybe return to 67 borders or something like that. That's what international law would say, but you know, international law is not either effective or necessarily proletarian. So
the law is bad.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, what does that, if the, are we now in a world where this two-state solution, talking about a two-state solution as a leftist, is as fantastical as a one-state solution?
I think so.
You're conjuring something out of your imagination of some world where there is peace between Israel and Palestine as two separate states.
I don't think so. And the reason why is fairly straightforward, which is just that, like, until there is such a thing as a state, which is as like legally defined borders, which can be defended by a military that covers the what is typically recognized as Palestinian territories, until such a reality as that, any further more practicable solution is even more fantastical, which is just to say that, like, however much a one-state solution is A, more desirable, and B, also more practical in the longer term, it's not desired and it's not possible because of the non-material factors, which I think they have to be discussed equally. Materially speaking, yes, the two-state solution is basically not possible. But yet, until such a time as there is a two-state solution, a one-state solution is entirely impossible.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
It's kind of like how, you know, we can maintain this kind of Leninist position of the rights of nations to self-determination and also oppose nationalism, but recognize that until, you know, a nation can assert itself as an equal partner in the world, the unity of nations is an impossibility, unless it is forced. There's either forced assimilation or else there's voluntary assimilation. But voluntary assimilation is only possible as a result of voluntary union, which is only possible as a result of equality of based on separation or whatever.
Right, but that's the point I'm making, that equality based on separation, which presumes sovereignty of both parties, is impossible so long as the state of Israel, as it exists now, continues.
Right.
Well, that's the main impediment.
That's probably true, but the state of Israel as it exists now isn't going to go away until the state of Israel as it exists after the result of losing the Palestinian territories, until that exists.
Okay.
So basically, you know.
Right. I mean, like, a state of Israel as it exists now could not exist if a state of Palestine with its own military to defend itself existed, right? Like, if Israel could not just fire into Gaza at will with no repercussions outside of the stochastic violence directed at its population every once in a while.
If you couldn't move to the West Bank from the U.S. and just steal a house from someone and then videotape yourself telling the old woman crying in the front yard that, like, oh, I stole your house, but if I didn't steal your house, somebody else would. Until such a time as that can't happen, nothing else that is more desirable can happen either.
Right.
I mean, there's talk
Mentioned Chomsky. We mentioned Chomsky a few times, and he's been in the news a little bit lately for having received huge payments from Jeffrey Epstein, who is likely a Mossad asset. Jeffrey Epstein. I think that seems to be the thinking man's guess about where Epstein fits in, based on his relationship to Ghislaine Maxwell and others. I wonder if payments received by Noam Chomsky from Jeffrey Epstein have anything to do with Chomsky's his increasing liberalism over the past, 10, 15 years, 20 years.
30,
I mean, that's,
years. God,
that's certainly a better explanation than just, if you don't have a liberal position, then you can't teach a masterclass.
Oh my God.
I mean, who knows? Maybe Chomsky
that's
was
just a guess.
Visiting the fucking, the fucking island, and they had shit on dirt on him or something. My sense of all that is just that Chomsky, I don't know, it's kind of like being in the media. It's not like people are castigated by some secret ruling elite that censor them and make them fall in line. It's just that,
yeah,
you know, you rise and fall based on your own inclinations toward what is preferred by those who are in power, you know? So in other words, people in the media say what they like because the people who have power like what they say.
Yes, yes. And I think that I think it's
probably a similar situation with Chomsky and Epstein or whatever that, my understanding of that situation was that Epstein was part of the thing that he was trying to do was curry favor with MIT.
Right.
And so he was like giving benefits and stuff to the standout members of the faculty there as part of like currying favor with MIT. Chomsky was a beneficiary of that. And Chomsky, I think since the decline, he's always been a critic of the Soviet Union as an anarchist, but since the decline of the Soviet Union, collapse of the Soviet Union, he turned hard into, I'm an anarchist, but...
always been his line.
Possible, you know.
No, Chomsky's anarchism has always been interwoven with sort of liberal arguments that are working their way into the core of liberalism, from which anarchism shares a genealogy.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, all American anarchists are just liberals, essentially.
Well, they're using anarchist arguments to try and go inside liberalism and switch people on to certain things. They're not necessarily converting people to anti-capitalist points of view.
Not only are they not necessarily, but they are definitely in no cases actually doing that.
And that's always been what he's done. Going back to like his going on to the firing line and debating Vietnam. His arguments have always been real politic, sort of liberal, basically going inside of someone else's edifice and arguing against their position.
Trojan horsing your idea into saying, like, by your own logicing them.
Eminent critique, I think, is what
we sort basically of made. The entire left has. Oh, go ahead.
So we made a whole episode about socialists doing this,
right? You know, there's a more complex version of this that probably not worth going into right now. But the left, since the decline of the Communist Party, which is to say the decline of an independent left, it's not because of the Popular Front, although the Popular Front helps make it happen very quickly.
So earlier,
it sort of eases the transition.
Yeah, exactly.
The Popular Front just makes it. Yeah. Go ahead, Ben.
I need to speak with my eyes open. Earlier, we were discussing sort of
why do you have to speak with your eyes open?
So I can see when someone else is finished.
Oh, okay.
So we were talking earlier, I don't know if we were recording, about the limitations of moral politics, which is sort of defines the American left as a whole. And the pro-Palestinian anti-Zionist movement right now, and you can have critiques of that and say, without some political, strictly speaking, political program, this is not going to ascend beyond its own sort of reverberations. But I was watching this interview with a former IDF soldier who was basically just deconstructing all the stuff you were alluding to earlier, Jason, all of the programming that Israeli citizens go through. And I think there is a politics inside of this that is ongoing. And it's I don't know, part of it is reclaiming for Jews and Israeli Jews and in the diaspora and all of the allies as well, the legacy of anti-Zionist Jewishness that preceded the founding of the Zionist state. And right. I bring this up because our friend of the podcast, Daniel, he just happened to be reading this. We discovered this book when we were reading Revolution together, Jason, by Isaac Deutscher, the non-Jewish Jew and other essays. And he just sent me this screenshot. I just wanted to share it with you guys, if you don't mind. He's painting a picture of sort of Jewish consciousness in the European arena before World War II. Fanatical enemies of Zionism were precisely the workers, those who spoke Yiddish, those who considered themselves Jews. They were the most determined opponents of the idea of an emigration from Eastern Europe to Palestine. In Poland in 1939, the Jewish population was for the last time electing the leaders of its communities, the kahilas. The communists, who were then very influential, regarded the kahilas as clerical institutions and boycotted the elections. The fiercely anti-Zionist Bund, Jewish Workers' Party, took part and polled the great majority of the votes. Only a relatively small sector of the socialist movement, the Poeli Zion, tried to combine socialism with Zionism. Jewish opinion in the West very often equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. According to this view, the Jews of Eastern Europe in their great majority were just anti-Semites. I love that line.
But
But this conclusion, of course, is an absurdity. This Jewish opposition to Zionism was a tragic opposition. It failed and ended in the perdition of the Jews. In the idea of an evacuation, of an exodus from the countries in which they had their homes and in which their ancestors had lived for centuries, the anti-Zionists saw an abdication of their rights, a yielding to hostile pressure, a surrender to anti-Semitism. To them, anti-Semitism seemed to triumph in Zionism, which recognized the legitimacy and validity of the old cry, "Jews, get out." The Zionists were agreeing to get out. And I just was like, wow, you sent that to me today, right before I'm about to record this podcast.
So that actually kind of makes me want to circle around to self-perceived nature of the Zionist project from the very beginning. And that is one of colonialism.
Yes.
Like, very self-consciously a colonial idea. And it has sort of taken on a life of its own. But it was always colonial and eliminationist from the time that Israel was founded. And even before that, you know, I guess by the time that Israel was founded, the eliminationists had sort of won the argument. And then the existence of labor Zionism on the ground in Palestine leading up to it is what helped settle that argument. But the colonial nature of it led to some strange bedfellows. And in that, when I say strange bedfellows, it's not that strange if you understand Zionism. That article that we read by, I don't remember who wrote it, but it was the Zionism False Messiah. It deals with the collaboration. Lance Selfa, there we go. Deals with the collaboration between Zionists and the actual literal perpetrators of the Holocaust before and during the Second World War. I think this is something that not a lot of people know about, because anytime I bring it up to other leftists who are pro-Palestine and anti-Zionist, they have no idea that Reinhard Heydrich literally had dealings with the Jews in Palestine, Zionist Jews in Palestine, and allowed for them to recruit in Germany and supported them.
Wait, but according to Netanyahu, the Muslims in Palestine were worse than the Nazis, though.
Right. The Nazis didn't actually even want to do the Holocaust until the Palestinian Muslims convinced them to do it. That's another thing that you hear a lot. Because there was an Arab like mufti in Palestine that was calling for the genocide of the Jews before Hitler explicitly began to do so.
Before they inaugurated the Final Solution, but not before, you know, not before Kristallnacht, not before any of the rest of it, just before the actual Holocaust.
Right.
But was it before or after Zionist settlers started making deals with the Ottoman Empire and buying up all the land and monopolizing the economy?
Many decades after.
Well, just a detail or two to worth mentioning.
But so the dealings between the Nazis and the Zionists are rather insidious, not just that they actually they got themselves dirty by bumping up against the Nazis, but that they actively tried to keep Jews from being able to escape Europe because they weren't going to Palestine. Like, they actively interfered. Like, the World Zionist Organization that worked out a transfer agreement with the Germans would transfer Jews to Palestine, allow Jews to be transferred out of Germany to Palestine, but nowhere else. And they actively sought to impede them from going into places like the UK. And let's see, I've got a quote here by Yitzhak Greenbaum, who says, "The disaster facing European Jewry is not my business." Oh, no, this is David Ben-Gurion said, "The disaster facing European Jewry is not my business," in 1943. And then Yitzhak Greenbaum said, "They will say I'm an anti-Semite, that I don't want to save the exile, that I don't have a warm Jewish heart. But let them say what they want. I will not demand that a Jewish agency allocate a sum of 300,000 or 100,000 pounds sterling to help European Jewry. And I think that whoever demands such a thing is performing an anti-Zionist act." And then Ben-Gurion later says, "If I knew that it would be possible to save all the children in Germany by bringing them to England and only half of them by bringing them to Israel, that I would opt for the second alternative. We must weigh not only the life of these children, but also the history of the people of Israel." So it's like, there's this just complete disregard for the lives of Jews if they're not going to serve the cause of Zionism.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And also, the other thing I was thinking about earlier when we were finding the parallels to Nazism is the reclamation of ancient history or of deep history or whatever towards this weird, you can describe this better than I can, Chris, but like, so the Zionist settler colonial project is explicitly a Eurocentric vision. It wants to de-Arabize the native Jewish population. And it, you know, all the rhetoric that, we have talked about racial purity and so forth, and kind of spiritual degeneracy. And but at the same time, it's claiming to have this ancestral right from antiquity to this land. It, and it's a very interesting contradiction. And I suppose that contradiction exists for the Third Reich as well, with what they're doing in history. I don't know how to describe it exactly, but they're...
One of the interesting things is that, like, the Germans saw, like, the land of Bohemia and Moravia, which are the Czech lands, as being historically German lands. And they thought that there was a salvageable population there that was just Slavic-speaking, but was essentially Aryan. So they had a goal of Germanizing these salvageable populations and then expelling the rest, right? The absorption of Bohemia and Moravia by the Nazis is very close to what the vision for Palestine would be for the Zionists. Eliminate or drive out the population that cannot be Europeanized.
If we're just focusing on the salvageable populations, according to this Ella Shoad article, you had a significant portion of the Zionist movement that wanted nothing to do with the Sephardic Jewish population or native Arab Jewish population. They were strictly eliminationist because it was all compromised. So there wasn't anything to salvage. They just wanted the land.
The point of that article that I found to be the most interesting is that the conditions for inclusion within the society was the Europeanization of the Sephardim and the Mizrahi. So that, like, and I think I heard elsewhere on that the podcast that you sent us, which I guess I'll link in the show notes too because I don't remember the name of it, where they talk about the de-indigenization of Algerian Jews under French occupation. So Algerian Jews became full citizens, while the North African population, the other North Africans, like the Arabs and Berbers and whatever, whoever else was there, were not considered French citizens and were a subject population. So the Jews in Algeria were de-indigenized, and a lot of them moved to France. And so for like about 100 and something years, I don't remember how long, they were integrated into French society. And in that instance, they lost their indigenous sort of like, they lost the material ties to indigeneity, right? Because they became part of the subject population through absorption, which is akin to what happens to the indigenous Jews of Israel.
Yes.
By allying themselves to the invading population that is oppressing the subject, the other indigenous population that is there, they de-indigenize themselves.
It's sort of like
their material interests are now aligned with those of the invading Europeans.
Right. It's sort of like whenever the Iraqis under Saddam, whenever they invaded Kuwait, and the Bedouin population became citizens for the first time, and they became, oh, they're cheerleaders for Iraq's occupation of Kuwait, but all the Kuwaitis saw them as occupiers. Only, you know, that was very short amount of time, so that
like a few months.
Yeah, but if it had lasted for 100 years instead, the difference would be probably similar to what you're just describing right now.
Also, that population, Chris, they didn't come around right away. I think it was like a little before, certainly after World War I and the British Mandate is when you have this absorption of the native Jewish population into the project. Initially, they don't really want anything to do with it because they're like, the Zionists are pariahs.
Right. No, you're right. It has everything to do with the adoption of, or not the adoption, the absorption of Ottoman territory by the British Empire and the Balfour Declaration.
And that's kind of like a to today,
Cherokee allies to the Confederacy.
Totally. And I was just about to say, fast forwarding to today, now that they have been absorbed and sort of pacified and make up a significant part of the right, Sephardic Jews, whatever intact relationship they have to tradition is seen as attractive. So that's what kind of made intermarriage pick up because it was one of the things that could tie, you know, Europeanized lineages to something more authentic, quote unquote. That's how we treat Native Americans here. It's like, how many white people do you know? They're like, oh, you know, we got Cherokee in my family. You know,
yes, especially Southern whites. You know, the aristocratic pretensions of the planter class.
Yeah.
They wanted to justify themselves as more than just colonizers, right, or not just the inheritors of the American tradition of coming from England and whatever. So they. Mostly it was fictional, and in some cases it might be a little bit true, but in any case, officially they tied their bloodlines to the indigenous population because that made their claims to their aristocratic privileges, they made them more legitimate.
Yep.
It's kind of the same reason why, because the Zionist project has been so successful, now Israeli is a thing, and so Israeli Jews can't go back to anywhere.
Right.
Right.
Which is why I think that, like, realistically, there can only be a one-state solution, because there's really no viable state in Palestine where you can't even join up the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights. They have no access to the sea. They've got no access to the same water rights and resources that the Israelis have. You know, there's not a viable state that can exist, and there's not a place to send back all the Jews either. It's right. Not even, if it was possible, it wouldn't even be desirable. So there's, like, the only real possibility for for peace in the region would have to be like what happened in apartheid South Africa, would just be the abolition of the states that exist now and the reconstitution, right, of a new one that included everyone. Which would be messy, and is still messy in South Africa. And I think a lot of that has to do with economic inequality in South Africa.
Yes,
but, and that's why
stayed rich,
right?
Ultimately, socialism is the answer, even if it has to be applied as a result of a process which begins with the state formation, and then advances to state integration and whatever else. Like, you can't just say communism is the answer, because because there's nothing you can do with that. That's just a way to wash your hands of the situation and stay above it.
It's looking for the black cows.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Well, there's discussion of a confederated state, which kind of already names the messiness that would be involved in any state. But
that's probably better than two distinct states having to figure out how to eventually confederate. Maybe you just start with the confederated state. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
The reason why we can't go back, we can't the reason why the false, or at least partially false, interpretation of from the river to the sea aimed at Israel is impossible is not because, to quote Joe Biden, there's no safety for Jewry around the world without the state of Israel, and if it didn't exist,
isn't that a wild fucking thing for an American president to say? It's like, fucking insane.
It's pretty insane.
without the official reason to dislike Jews for the first time, then then Jews would not be a safe.
Yeah, but
I'm not saying that I dislike Jews. I'm just saying the reason why a lot of people are anti-Semitic today around the world is because of Israeli actions and the conflation of Zionism with Judaism.
Their project. They succeeded.
Yeah.
And this is leading me into this quote that Lanselfa has from 1972 from members of the Israeli Socialist Organization. And they said, Zionism promised national awakening and fraternal solidarity. It has produced a society of increasing inequality, of racist discrimination and cultural oppression. Zionism promised independence. It has produced a society in which the prime minister must periodically affirm to the people that the existence of the nation depends on the delivery of 50 or 100 phantom jets from the United States. Zionism promised physical security to the Jews. Israel is the most dangerous place on earth today for a Jew, and it will remain so as long as Israeli Jewish society retains its colonial character and its function as an instrument of imperialism. And word. Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, yeah. I haven't heard any of these kinds of voices from within Israel for a while.
That's because they have all left Israel in the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
But that's so prophetic.
Like, it's you cannot just be a critic of Israel in Israel. You know, I mean, they do not have the cultural freedom to do so, though technically they have the legal freedom to do so. I mean, they have the legal freedom to do so the way that we in the United States have the legal freedom to criticize our government under the Patriot Act. Right?
Well, it's kind of like
being that freedom until they decide to take it away.
Yeah, it's like being a Trotskyist under Brezhnev. You can do it, right. But it's like, it's not just frowned upon, but like maybe it's a psychological condition you have, and also your neighbors are going. Your neighbors might beat you up, even if the police won't.
I was going to say that. Yeah, you're not safe in the streets. Yeah.
That was my point. That was my whole point. That is what I was trying to get around to.
It's approaching what it's like to be anti-Zionist in any institution in the United States.
Right. Yeah,
yeah, I guess that's true.
Or especially higher education.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But except, I suppose the difference, though, is that the actions increasingly, it is increasingly the case that the actions of the Israeli state are very seemingly very divorced from the self-perceived interests of most Americans, whereas it's not the case in Israel for Israelis,
right.
You know. The self-perceived interests of Israelis in Israel is... I just want to go about my life and be left alone and not be threatened by, you know, violent, random incidents of stochastic violence from Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So leave me alone. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about you. So I support my government obliterating these people who threaten my safety and security in my daily life.
I got to go to the shopping mall with my AK. I got to, right. You know. Yeah.
Oh, it would be an AR-15, yeah. Probably, or whatever. One of those weird Israeli guns that look like they're from fucking Starship Troopers.
And you have to recognize that that is a legitimate concern for one's own safety is a legitimate.
That's true.
Thing. And a lot of the people who don't want who would be critics of Israeli policy and don't want to be subjected to this violence pick up and leave if they're able. So there's just not a lot left
right.
in Israel.
And I think that's why one of the big criticisms of the Netanyahu government has been that the October 7th attacks are ultimately the fault of Netanyahu and the Likud for a multiplicity of reasons. The more liberal reasons being like your policy towards the Palestinians and the allowing settlers and whatever else, and then the less liberal reasons being like you haven't been eliminationist enough, or the conspiracy theory ones is like, oh, you let this happen in order to be able to have a Israeli 9/11.
Which I can understand. I mean, I'm suspicious of that, but it's kind of like with 9/11. There are all kinds of colossal failures occurring. There are concurrent failures too in the security state. So it basically invites conspiratorial thinking.
The alternative, like the lost horizon here, is a Jewish socialism or a socialism inclusive of Jews that precluded the need for a homeland, right? Like if Lenin and Trotsky and Zinoviev's vision of a Soviet Union with equal rights and equal representation for all ethnicities was more desirable and less Stalinist, and if there was never a... All of this was predicated on there not having been a Holocaust, because a Holocaust was, by the Zionists' own words, a godsend to them. All of this precludes the Holocaust not happening. And the Holocaust was not inevitable. And neither was even the German rise to power. not German rise to power, the Nazi rise to power in Germany. That
Which is to say it's the fault of the Comintern.
It is really the fault of the Comintern. It's the I would say that the German SPD is equally to blame.
Yeah, but also that's partially because there was a Comintern, which means there was nothing inside the SPD to check the drift that the SPD took.
You're right about that. Right. Okay, you're setting us up for some serious criticism here, but I stand by it. I'd say the Comintern was a bad idea. And it,
I think a future episode about that is probably a good idea.
The Comintern was a net negative. The
Comintern?
The Comintern was a net negative. Trying to impose the Bolshevik model on all of the revolutionary parties of the world, regardless of whether or not it was useful, ended up being totally negative. And I think our examples that we've talked about on our Patreon episodes specifically are the Czechoslovak Czechoslovak Social Democratic Party and the American Socialist Party.
Right. The American Socialist Party, in which even the far right of the party was entirely pro-Bolshevik, which means that to split the party, you had to invent reasons to be in line with the Comintern policy. You had to make up things about the other side because the furthest right-wing figure was still a revolutionary socialist and pro-Bolshevik. You know, but he's the right. So we have to split because splitting is what we have to do to be in the Comintern.
Right. And that's what happened with the Czechoslovak party as well. The Czechoslovak communists split out of the Social Democratic Party, ended up becoming a minority, even though they were a majority within the Social Democratic Party. And then after, you know, hemorrhaging membership and being, ineffectual in Czechoslovak parliament, adopted the exact same strategy that the Social Democratic Party had, which was just to maintain an electoral party and try to transition to socialism through parliament,
which is the same thing that the American party did too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Regarding splits, why not go back to the very beginning? You know, what the formation of the Bolshevik party came about over the exclusion of the Jewish Bund as a separate entity. Right.
Well, that was one reason. But again, I think that's the reason why we have to have a separate episode, because I feel like I could defend the split in the Russian Social Democratic Party, but I can't defend the eradication of the Menshevik pole of attraction afterward.
Right.
But anyways, that really is a separate episode. So we have now, that's a preview, everyone.
the point that I'm trying to make here is that the socialists had the ball and we fumbled it.
Yes.
Right.
What happened was the Holocaust and the State of Israel.
And the State of Israel was first recognized by the USSR.
Right.
Which means the socialists have fumbled the ball in two or three games at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lost horizon where the World Socialist Movement is the home of international Jewry, and the international working class, you know, isn't marginalized and ineffectual.
So, if we were to scale down our historical fiction sort of account of, like, here's a different road not taken, and instead confine ourselves to a world where the Holocaust did happen.
Right.
And Israel was going to be founded and recognized in Palestine. Is there any way that Israeli project could have gone and could have developed without being what it is? Or is the State of Israel something that is simply wholly indefensible, and without knowing what would have, without the benefit of hindsight, was the USSR's decision to recognize the State of Israel? Like, what would be the arguments at that time, in that place? What would be the arguments against recognizing the State of Israel?
Well, so Hal Draper was very sympathetic to Zionism and also horrified at the State of Israel. So as far back as the early 60s, it was already an impossible position to have. And so to be honest, I don't really know the answer. I think that moving forward, it's much clearer than looking even just like one generation back.
Yeah. I would say that, like, in the DNA of the Zionist movement is a settler colonial project.
Yes.
Like from the very right. beginning, it was consciously conceived of as such. So I don't think that there's any other way things could have gone, except for the other way that we mentioned, which was the exploitative versus eliminationist route.
Yeah.
Right? Like there could have been a...
So in other words, if the Zionist bourgeoisie had been more dominant...
Yes.
Perhaps.
Yes,
and it actually would have been a better project.
Right.
Unless some major things change within the global working class movement... The road forward is maybe just a incorporation of the state of Israel as a colony of an outside state, which is also not desirable.
Greater Syria.
Yeah.
Well,
I was being serious, but I also want to emphasize that I also don't think that is desirable either.
That was attempted. But so to quote Edward Said, Kevin, Zionism never spoke of itself unambiguously as a Jewish liberation movement, but rather as a Jewish movement of colonial settlement in the Orient. That's how it always marketed itself to Gentile. Of course, anti-Semitism is a prevailing reality, but it's with the Holocaust that it's able to refashion itself as this liberatory colonial project. And I really don't know. I think I am... sympathetic to certain kinds of cultural Zionism, quote unquote, that argues for a Jewish homeland. I think it's when you get into the privation of that comes with statehood, that comes with exclusionary monopolization and obviously de-Arabization and ethnic cleansing and all of that stuff, that it's
right.
From the beginning.
Creation of an ethno-state.
But that's from the very, very, very beginning. So if you want to weed out people like that are more sympathetic, like perhaps Moses Hess at the very beginning and later Martin Buber, that's doable, and it complicates things. And the Holocaust complicates everything. But I don't think there's an argument for a Zionist state now at all. I think there's an argument for... a Jewish homeland. How do you extricate those things at this point? That's seems almost impossible, but maybe.
Well, yeah, because you can't revive the Ottoman Empire.
As much as the Turks would like to.
As much as Erdogan's very obvious and conscious mission is neo-Ottomanism, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And if it did happen, it would just mean you would need a new Arab revolt and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know how to end this because I don't know the answer to the primary question posed by the existence of the state of Israel. I don't really know what to do
at this point. Like honestly, like we've mentioned before, I don't. There just doesn't look like a good solution. Like how do you exist with your oppressor and the people that had just tried to genocide you? You know, like how do you do that?
Yeah.
I mean. No one would have asked the Jews to do it after the Holocaust, you know?
Right, exactly. And impossibly, maybe the only solution, quote unquote, is an internationalist one. Maybe for the time being, there is no national solution.
There's a certain liberal perspective which would point to Darfur or Rwanda as a possible example of not what to do, but I mean... yes, what to do, but after the thing that you didn't want to happen has already happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the Reconciliation Commission and so on.
Yes.
But like, I don't know enough about this to be able to say one way or the other.
With Rwanda, you had an ICC that was willing to do something.
Well, right. Yeah, I guess that matters a lot.
And here with Israel, so the problem I do think is always international, which is to say based with us, the U.S., so we are inside of the problem.
Oh. Euer narrischer Zionisten mit eurer narrischen Seichel, ihr mögt doch gehen zu dem Arbeiter und lernen bei ihm Seichel. Ihr mögt doch gehen zu dem Arbeiter und lernen bei ihm Seichel. Ihr wollt uns führen kann Jerusalem, wir sollen dort Goladein, wir wollen besser sein in Russenland, wir wollen sich befreien. Wir wollen besser sein in Russenland, wir wollen sich befreien. Oh, you foolish little Zionists, with your utopian mentality, you'd better go down to the factory and learn the workers' reality. You'd better go down to the factory and learn the workers' reality. You want to take us to Jerusalem so we can die as a nation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and fight for our liberation. We'd rather stay in the diaspora and work for our liberation.
Глупенькие сионисты, вы такие утописты, вы бы лучше шли в рабочие или в трубочисты, вы бы лучше шли в рабочие или в трубочисты. В Иерушалаим идти за вами не желаем, мы в России останемся бороться с Николаем, мы в России не останемся бороться с Николаем.
Wir wollen besser sein in Russland, wir wollen sich befreien.